All right, so here we are, episode two, Conversations with Frederick Jones L. All right, so what we're going to talk about here in this first episode is we're going to talk about our relations, right, as a community and as a demographic with immigrants who look like us, but don't share the same history, the same ancestry, the same culture, the same customs, etc., right? Right? So we're going to get into some of this. So obviously, as of late, reparations has been a big topic, right? A major topic, obviously. So with that, it has been bringing out a lot of the ancient hatreds, is what I'm going to call it, between immigrant groups, obviously, who can pass for black or who are classed as black in the USA, and those in the USA who is from the lineage that the black designation was initially put on. Right. We had the slave marks, Negro, black and colored, etc., placed upon us. And then you get immigrants that come here and they kind of get lumped in with us as far as those tags are concerned. Right. Right. So with that being said, being at reparations again has become a hot topic as of late. You get to see how a lot of immigrants from the Caribbean, right, Jamaica, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Cuba, all right, and then you have those from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, all right, people from places like Liberia, Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea, Senegal, Burkina Faso, Ghana, right, etc. So they'll come and they'll have the position like, oh, slavery was a long time ago. Why are you guys still talking about reparations for slavery? You was never a slave. You're not a victim. All right. All talking points that are usually used by so-called white people when they're in opposition to what our people want to do politically. They'll bring up black on black crime. And usually a lot of immigrants, especially West Africans in particular, but Africans from other parts of the continent as well, and these Caribbean immigrants from South and Central America, They're disingenuous with these positions that they take, right? So I say that to say this is not necessarily how they feel, but because they want to be white adjacent, is what I'm going to call it here, they'll say these things out of politics, all right, just to secure, I guess, a place where their fellow countrymen can run to when they want foreign visas, right? When they want to come here on a student visa or a work visa, or if they're a political refugee of some sort, it's political. So they're never going to be politically, I guess, not aligned with the dominant society, which is so-called white people, because of the benefit, because of tangibles, and not because they hold these positions near and dear to their heart. So they'll be diametrically opposed to what our people, the American freedmen, also known as foundational black Americans, also known as the American descendants of those who was in U.S. chattel slavery, right? They'll take these positions against us because of politics and not because they know that they're standing on truth. And it's all intellectual dishonesty for the most part. I believe part of it is mental illness. All right. Some of their people have mental illness, low IQ, special needs. Some are in denial, too. They don't want, especially these West African immigrants, they don't want to talk about slavery. They don't even want to hear it from us. And that's because they were a willing participant. All right. They partnered with this European. But they play psychological games like, oh, you were stolen. Slavery was a long time ago. It's because they want to avoid the issue because they know their role in it. All right. They know West Africa's role in it. I mean, the slave castles are still there. And for whatever reason, our people go there and do slave tourism. For the life of me, I cannot figure out why they want to go and relive their ancestors' trauma. And a lot of us ain't playing with a full deck. We damage goods. We got generational trauma. And you name it. You name it, right? So when you start getting into some of this history, you really learn where these immigrants are coming from. All right. A lot of them feel like this is not their ancestral estate. So they have to somehow associate or attach themselves to us to be relevant, right? Whether they're claiming to be black, so they get all of the tangibles. You have got to be. Oh, sorry. No, I thought something happened, right? So they claim to be black, so they'll get all of the tangibles that comes with that, whether it's affirmative action, whether it's set aside like grants and scholarships that are specifically reserved for us. But being that they come here and hide in our lineage for tangibles, they get to participate. But then they have their own set asides and things for their own people that we can't partake in. So they can come here and be me, and they can be themselves, but I can't be me and be them, right? Like I can't get a Haitian scholarship. Somebody who's from my lineage can't get a Nigerian scholarship, but they can get a black scholarship and a Nigerian scholarship, right? So these are some of the things that we're talking about. So they're only with us when it's beneficial to them, but when it's beneficial to us and when it's time to start dealing in politics and having a conversation about repair, or like if we're saying that we want to desegregate the data or we want to delineate, all of a sudden we're crazy. We have a colonizer's mindset. We are xenophobic. But they don't truly feel like that. This is what they'll say so that the gravy train doesn't stop. Right. And these people are really clever with it. You really got to pay attention. And I blame some of this on our conscious movements because we have a tendency to practice all this. We are the world. Whether it's Pan-Africanism or not, if it's consciousness, this is what they use to kind of low-rise and sneak their way in. But politically, they're not doing politics with you. They're not doing politics with us. They're not advocating on your behalf for anything. They're doing their own politics for everything. But then tell you we all one. So that we don't focus on their evil schemes, right? But let's get back to this African, because I was talking about them initially. Then I start talking about immigrants from the Caribbean, South and Central America as well. But let's get back to this West African, right? Because, see, when we start talking about reparative justice for our people here and how that all ties into U.S. chattel slavery, a lot of them have a tendency to think that we're talking about hundreds of years ago, 400 years ago. That was a long time ago. Nobody was alive then, right? This is what they say to us. You American blacks need to move on. But when it comes to the Jews in the Holocaust and they say never forget, I don't hear these parasites telling Eastern European so-called Israeli Jews or those who are not in Israel, Jews, the Khazars, or the Ashkenazis, those of Ashkenaz, I don't hear them telling them to move on, right? They say never forget and you on mute. When we're talking about 9/11, the slogan or the phrase is never forget. I don't hear them saying move on. When this goddamn Pilgrim is doing the Civil War reenactments or the War of 1812 or even the American Revolution, which is before that. When they do those reenactments and preserve that history, they don't say move on. Don't bring that up. But it's only when we're talking about our 400-year Holocaust, right? So I say all that to say this because I want to get to this segue right here. We don't have to use 400 years ago or even 200 years ago to substantiate our claim for reparative justice and all of the tangibles associated with it. We don't. We can just use the 100 years of domestic terrorism that our people faced starting around 1865, which was Reconstruction, going to civil rights, 1965. We could just use those 100 years right there. And people say, oh, nobody was alive during this. Listen, the time frame that I just lived, I have two ancestors, well, more than two, but I'm just going to use my mother and my grandmother. They was alive. My mother was born in the 50s. All right. That's right in the smack of the civil rights era. Maybe even before the civil rights movement even came about, when our people was really being oppressed in the Deep South. Then my grandmother was born in the 30s. So you know she's seen some things. 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And they're both still living. And we're talking about sundown towns, racial restrictive covenants on property deeds, massive lynchings, the destruction of our towns all across this country, from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Elaine, Arkansas, to I forget the name of the town, but it was in North Carolina, where the white supremacists overthrew the government because they had a few so-called black Republicans in seats of power. All right. There's Jim Crow. We can go to segregation. There's convict leasing, tenant farming, also known as sharecropping, also known as debt peonage. Now, let me say this about that, about the debt peonage, the sharecropping, and the tenant farming and whatnot. I have found on census records, doing my genealogy, that my ancestors were sharecroppers. On the census records, it's not going to say sharecropping or tenant farming. It's going to say farm labor or farm laborer or farmer or even farm apprentice. And I have so many censuses that say this. Like, we'll start with my maternal grandmother's mother's side. So we'll go to her mother, then her father. So her mother's family is from Chester County, Pennsylvania. All of the censuses for them, from we'll say 1930, they was doing farm work. 1920, right? The census is every 10 years. 1910, we can go back. And I say that to say, after slavery, where do you think our people stayed at? Where do you think they was doing this farming at? In the same place where they was working the plantations. So even after slavery, they stayed on the plantations because that's what they knew. And you don't see until industrialization, early half, mid 1900s, which is the 20th century, is when you see us start to come to northern cities, for those of our ancestors who weren't already in northern cities, because the cities was coming industrialized to work. So if 9 times out of 10, if your ancestor was a sharecropper of some sort, they was a plantation slave. So this stuff is not rocket science, right? So on my maternal grandmother's mother's side, you know, I have, so my maternal grandmother's mother was a woman named Ruth Warfield Stone. Her husband was somebody named James Warfield. All right. So they both was born around 1914. So they was of age in the 20s, the late 20s. So James Warfield wind up being a World War II veteran later. But prior to that, he was a postal worker. All right. All right. So this is 1920s. Now, when you get to their parents, right, Ruth Warfield Stone and James R. Warfield's parents, Now we getting into people born in the 1800s. Right then and there, when you start looking at census records when they was alive, you see farm labor starting there. So just with two times great grandparents, these are people on the plantation. Even though slavery is abolished, this is what they're doing. And that's just my maternal grandmother's mother's side, or my maternal grandmother's father's side, which these are people from Jefferson County, Wiley, Georgia, who migrated to Philadelphia during World War I, which is around the time of the first great migration, if I'm saying it right, which is between 1910 and 1940. When you look at their censuses, they're all farm labor. And rightfully, obviously, because it's Georgia. It's not Philadelphia, right? So we're talking farm labor 1910, because they came to Philadelphia between 1910 and 1920. So they came between censuses, right? So 1910, they're on the farm, they're on the plantation. 1900, 1890, 1880, and 1870. There's no 1860 census for them, obviously, because it's the Deep South. That's still slavery. But there is 1860 for my Chester County, Pennsylvania family, because obviously Pennsylvania had been slavery had been outlawed in Pennsylvania since 1780. Now, that doesn't mean no slaves were bought into the territory and that people didn't wind up slaves. But on a state level, these slavery was outlawed. So you had more free persons of color, so-called free, in a state like Pennsylvania versus somewhere like Georgia, right? So that's the sharecropping situation. Oh, and let me mention my maternal grandfather's side, which both his parents are from Danville, Virginia, and Caswell County, North Carolina, which Caswell County, North Carolina, and Danville, Virginia is like close, right? They're both on opposite sides of the North Carolina-Virginia border, so they're close. So when you start getting with them, my maternal grandfather's father, so this is just my great-grandfather, was a farm laborer. Okay, so we're talking in the 30s, just the 1930s. And then his father was his father, so forth and so on. So we can just go back to the 1930s and have a claim. And you know how sharecroppers were treated, how they were robbed, and they called the debt peonage. All right, so moving along, then you have what's called the vagrancy laws. There's urban renewal, which James Baldwin infamously called Negro removal. There's redlining. There's racial steering. There's predatory lending with subprime loans or subprime mortgages. And with the subprime mortgages during the Great Migration periods, the FHA, if I'm not mistaken, either the FHA hadn't formed yet or they hadn't backed loans that would be given to non-whites, something to that effect, which allowed these landlords, for lack of a better way to name them, they would, instead of selling our people a house under the FHA standard, they would sell a house on contract. So this is the predatory lending, all right, where our people will have to pay a down payment like they're buying a house, but they wouldn't have all of the benefits of a buyer. Like, they're not gaining any equity. They often were overcharged. If something in the house broke, they would be on the hook for it, but the landlord would charge them for it, then fix it. But they're not gaining any equity. And then it's kind of like if you're in an apartment and you're renting, the landlord is going to take care of everything at no cost to you. But this particular arrangement, it wasn't that way. Our people had to pay. And if you miss one payment, you were gone with no remedy and recourse in the courts. All right. So this is what they call selling a house on a contract during the Great Migration. And this is what they did to steer us into communities that would be redlined, because only in certain communities they would even allow us to rent, is what I'm going to call it. I'm not even going to call it selling the house on the contract, because it was kind of like what they call renting to own, right? So I guess this was renting to own before that was a thing. Okay. And speaking of that, just in 2010, it was found that Wells Fargo, they was giving subprime loans or subprime mortgages to our people who were creditworthy applicants, but they was giving them subpar or subprime mortgages and loans because of their ethnic background, which is against the law, right? So there's that. There's the selling a house on contract that I just talked about, where they didn't have the benefit of a renter or a homeowner, right? And it wasn't a deal that was FHA backed. Then there's the exclusionary zoning laws. There's the Homestead Act, the Compensated Emancipation Act of 1862, where in Washington, D.C., slave owners was compensated. There's more than 100 years of domestic terrorism, which is kind of what I'm touching on. And all this has contributed to our generational trauma and why there is a wealth gap. And the only way to fix it is with set asides, right? And, you know, man, like, we need a transformative black agenda. And, yeah. So when we start talking about reparations, this is really what we're talking about. We don't have to go back to 1555 and when we was taken from Africa. We don't have to do that. And I think this is what a lot of immigrants try to reduce the conversation to, or rather what they'll falsely claim that this is what we are trying to do, right? Or rather, this is what we're trying to discuss. And that's just simply not true. Right. And so the case for reparations is clear. I mean, the evidence is just overwhelming. Like, we'll take this, for example. Like, I noticed one of the talking points of a lot of these immigrants is so-called black people are on welfare. You guys are on welfare. You guys are on Section 8. And it's like, where are you getting this stuff? Like, are you people really just this not in the know? Or do you just say things because you think it's a clapback because you heard it and you think it's something worthy? But the reality of it is this. First of all, the numbers say that it's more so-called white people on welfare than us. Not only us, but than more than any other group, whether it's per capita. Right now, per capita would be like, let's say you take 1,000. Like, you're counting 100,000 people in an area. All right. Even if it's per capita, they're going to dominate the numbers because it's more of them. So per capita, it doesn't matter. The numbers are still going to come out. Overall numbers are still going to come out where they're the highest. Now, if you just do the outright numbers of their people, right, like how many of them it is, and you do the percentage, they're going to dominate that. If you're calculating at all of the groups in the country, who has the highest percentage, it's going to be them because they dominate the numbers. It's not because they're any less capable, but they just dominate the numbers. But not only that. So let's touch on this. When welfare was created, and see, I ask immigrants, who created welfare, when, why? When you ask them the who, what, when, where, why, and how, they can't articulate it. But yet you got enough gall to tell us that we're on welfare. We Section 8. Listen, bro. First of all, welfare was created by FDR under something called the New Deal in 1935 after the Great Depression. And these programs was designed for so-called whites. It wasn't designed for us. We couldn't partake in these programs. We was locked out of these programs for 30 years until civil rights. Okay. And so-called white people build wealth off these programs. So they even got a head start on welfare. Okay. And by the time our people was even allowed to participate, they drastically downsized the programs and came up with this welfare to work legislation. You could thank former President Bill Clinton for that. Like when it comes to welfare fraud, they're the biggest fraudsters. They do it more often. They get caught more often. And when they get caught, it's like for millions. Like, there was a case out of Lakewood, New Jersey, where a community of Jews stole millions from the program. There's the story out of Utah where some Mormons, I want to say Warren Jeffs, if I'm saying that right, or somebody associated with that group, same thing. They took millions. And the reality of it is, bro, like these people can't come and stand on the square and defeat us when speaking on this information, because they're just simply not qualified. They're just simply not qualified. And not only that, too, like if, you know, like if you study, you'll see Native Americans even have their own welfare programs, like whether it's food distribution program on the Indian reservation, whether it's tribal TANF. TANF is an acronym that stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And, you know, man, like these Africans, like they literally have had a 400-year head start. And they're sitting on top of resources in their countries. They literally had a 400-year head start to build up their countries after trafficking our people for more than four centuries. But yet you not only haven't you built anything in your countries where you're sitting on resources, but then you run here while your leaders in your countries sell you out to the international community. And then you come here and have smoke for the American freedmen. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And don't let me get into all of the foreign aid that the United States sends around the world, which is essentially welfare to me. Just last year alone, the shithole Nigeria got $800 million in foreign aid from this country. But a Nigerian is going to come here and tell us that we're getting something for free when welfare is no longer free. Clinton changed that with the welfare to work. I mean, since COVID, they temporarily changed it, but that legislation still stands. You have to work to get welfare. So even welfare is not free, right? So, and see, it's these little things that these people don't know, right? Like they're not well-versed. And they don't have all of the details, right? So, I mean, like, yo, man, like, we could just go on and on and on. It's just so many things that we could talk about. Like, if we're talking about reparative justice, how about when Obama was in office? I think George Bush was coming out of office. Think about all the finance that was given to these corporate giants during the bailout, during the Obama years. It was essentially state-sanctioned and corporate welfare given to them. Nobody talks about that. All of the finance that Joe Biden sent to the Ukraine. Billions. I'm not going to say nobody has said anything about that. But the reality of it is, when these other people get a purse is what I'm going to call it. Nobody calls it out how they call us out when we say that we want repair. Right? We notice the double standard. So this is essentially what we're talking about when we're talking about some of this stuff. And we're just tired of misinformed, low IQ, intellectually dishonest immigrants that are special needs and have mental illness and that are in denial, and they be in this country and deny racism and Jim Crow, and they're just in denial because we know you experience the same things that we do, and you're just in denial, and that's because the lens that you view this country through is different from ours. You view this country as your sanctuary. I view this country as a place where my ancestors' blood was spilled and the debt needs to be made right. See? And you know, these people, they ain't playing with a full deck. They ain't playing with a full deck. Want to be white adjacent, are mischief makers, you name it. They'll do anything to get ahead, you name it. All right, so yeah, so time is of the essence in this particular episode or part, and we will pick it up on the next episode. So stay tuned. Yeah.